When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Standard Issue for all women.
Hello and welcome to episode 298 of the Standard Issue Posse. I'm Mickey Noonan, and look, I don't want to start with a whinge, but there is a review of us on Apple Podcasts that has got me baffled. I don't know if I want to know.
Is this, I don't
this
know
isn't
either.
The one that accuses us of hating Scotland, is it? It's the one that accuses us of hating Scotland, right? I'm going to read you a little bit. Anglocentric, that's the title. I know all the presenters and most of their guests are English, but I do think that a podcast that bills itself as being, quote, for all women, might do a bit more news about what's going on in other parts of the UK. They treat Scotland as a joke. There's the Edinburgh Fringe, good, worth bothering with. Literally everything else about Scotland is bad, silly, and a laughing stock.
Well, I mean, she's kind of proved her point there a little bit, because we are laughing.
That is true.
At this
I'd have thought Scotland would be more to the host taste in many ways. That would be if they bothered themselves to get educated about it. And my favourite bit of the review, 3 stars. We'll take the 3 stars, but what the fuck are you on about?
I think we have actually referred to Scotland on this very podcast as, in many ways, the best of us in terms of the
We
United
love a bit
Kingdom.
Of Scotland. And the reason I went back to this is because I was editing my interview for this week's podcast, which is with Scottish playwright Steph Smith, about her drama set in small town Scotland. Yeah, I mean, I didn't just slag her off and expect her to defend herself. I was interested in what she had to say.
Did you say to her, thanks very much, Steph. I am just going to demean you and your country of origin for the rest of this interview, because that's how we roll.
Yeah, she was fine with it. Yeah. I want to take this opportunity to apologise to the Channel Islands, because I don't think I've mentioned them in absolutely ages.
Guernsey does not get a lot of love, does it? To be
fair. It doesn't. I'm sorry.
Wow, we need to up our game. Now, the reason I bring this up is because it is one of the top 3 reviews on Apple Podcasts, and it really annoys me. So if you're listening and you think, you know, I can let them off for the fact that they clearly hate Scotland. No. Could you please do some more reviews so that that just fucks off on the homepage of Apple Podcasts?
Oh, that would be good, wouldn't it? Yeah.
It would.
I'm Hannah Dunleavy, and rather incredibly, I want to talk about some sport.
What? I'm excited to hear this.
Well, apologies if you were planning on talking about this, Jen, but I think
hope
it's
not,
actually,
Hannah.
I think it's so exciting it would actually bear repeating. Did either of you see what happened at the World Figure Skating Championships at the weekend?
I did, yes.
I'm pleased to say, Hannah, that I missed that. Please do talk me through it.
Okay, so the American, Ilya Malinin, pulled off just the most incredible thing. I mean, for a start, he did a quadruple axel and landed it, and then did the most incredible performance. He broke the world record for the score, and he was a clear 24 points ahead from the rest of the competition. He's 19 years old. And for anyone listening who doesn't know this, a quadruple axel, until 2022, it was believed that it wasn't humanly possible to do a quadruple axel. He did one in 2022. The point here is, he's done it again. And you could do something once, and then that's something you did. If you do it again, then it's something you do. And if he can do this, figure skating will never be the same again. And also, he's really pushing the boundaries of what a human body could do. Mickey, you're doing the mail out. Show me the mail out.
I'm going to put it in the mail out. But also, Hannah, what was the music he did his routine to?
He also did it to the Succession theme tune, which was just...
Shut up.
You've seen it, haven't you, Mickey?
Yeah, it made me a little bit weepy. You know when the human body does such incredible things?
Oh, it's really moving to watch, yeah.
It's really moving. And at the end, he just, like, falls onto the floor. He's clearly so, like, amazed by himself, and rightly so.
It's like Roger Bannister or something. It's, you know, Simone Biles. Like, certain people do things that nobody thought was humanly possible. And you have to step back and just go, wow.
Well,
like,
yeah, it's phenomenal.
Wow. In fact, Jen, the commentary on the version I watched, they actually give up commentating. At one point, the woman's just screaming. Like, screaming through the commentary. It's incredible.
Oh, the commentary on the one I watched was by someone Scottish, so I had to turn it off.
Fair.
It's a joke. There's just jokes.
I'm Jen Offord, and this morning my daughter told me about her good friend Nelson Mandela. So
she's moving in some high and indeed very dead circles, Jen.
Well, it did unfortunately lead directly to another chat about death, which I really wish she'd stop doing that, because it's just such a hard sell. We saw a woman carrying a lot of Costa coffee cups, and she said, why has she got so many coffees? And I said, oh, I don't know, maybe she's got a bunch of people in there that she's bought coffee for. Seems the most plausible explanation to me. And she was like, okay. She said, one day when we were waiting for my friend, daddy's girlfriend put some cream on my face. Don't know what the link was, but there we go. I said, all right, who's your friend? And she said, Nelson Mandela.
Wow.
I said, oh, really? Nelson Mandela? That's cool. I said, I'm just pretending, Mommy. He's dead. Who knows? Who knows?
Coming up, playwright Steph Smith chats to me about the return of her award-winning BBC drama Float, a tender look at life, love and identity in small-town Scotland.
Oh, why?
No, thank you.
Yeah, I just decided I'd ignore your protestations.
In Jenny Off the Blocks, thankfully nothing Scottish to talk about. We are inspiration-tastic with a side of triggering.
I feel like my request might have backfired.
And ignorance is bliss. Or maybe it's not. Either way, in Rated or Dated, we're watching 2004's Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
But first, migration problems, bullies in power, and will this ever be over? It's time for Rishi Sunak. Sorry, it's time for the Bush Telegraph. Cue Sting.
Bush Telegraph.
Welcome to the Bush Telegraph, where we think that it is very much your own fault if you've been chatting shit on Twitter.
Chat shit, get banged, Jenster.
Well, quite. We are, of course, talking about the very sad cancer diagnosis that Kate Middleton, the Princess of Wales, sorry, that's her name now, isn't it, announced at the end of last week, which, I don't know, basically what it seems to me has happened is she's been unwell, she's had an operation, she's been diagnosed, she's going to have to start treatment, she's been waiting for, you know, the right opportunity to talk to her kids about it, so they've obviously tried to keep it out of the news, and it's gotten to a point where people are being so fucking silly on Twitter that they've actually kind of been forced to announce it perhaps a little bit ahead of when they would like to have done. So obviously there's been loads of stuff in between. Hannah talked about it on last week's podcast and people speculating online, where is she, etc., etc. And it's just like, given that we knew that she'd had abdominal surgery, I just don't think it ever would have been that much of a stretch for people to go, well, maybe she's actually quite poorly.
Yeah, agrees.
And maybe not, you know, start speculating about what might have happened. And then, you know, for the people who've gone, well, actually, I don't feel any shame. It's the shame of their press office for handling it so badly. Just, like, fucking have some compassion, you absolute twat.
And own it. Own what you wrote.
Yeah. Be a bit shamefaced. Take it on the chin. Sit with that discomfort and learn a fucking lesson. Don't do it again.
Agreed.
Anyway, shall I move us on, Mick?
Move us on.
So I was reading a story this morning about how, despite quite a lot of Tory chat about how they're going to bring it down, net migration to the UK is actually up. That's according to the ONS. And it's not because of small boats either, which accounted for around 30,000 people of 2022's record high of 745,000 people arriving in the UK.
Now, maths isn't my strong point, but that isn't a huge percentage.
No, it's quite small, isn't it? It's less than 5%. I think that's less than 5%.
You're asking the wrong person. Just,
I know.
Just keep going, Jen. Just keep going.
Yeah,
power
okay.
on.
All right. So another story I saw in The Guardian this morning, and which relates to this, is that thousands of foreign nurses are leaving the UK to work abroad. In fact, 12,400 UK registered nurses left the UK between 2021 and 22 and 2022 and 23. That figure represents a fourfold increase from before the COVID-19 pandemic.
I tried to whistle, I failed. Ooh, no, I can't. That just sounds like I'm wooing. That is a lot.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's at a time when the NHS is under so much pressure, that does seem to me to be a bad thing.
I feel like you could lose the to me there. I feel it seems like a bad thing. Yeah.
Not least because the health service is already struggling with around 40,000 nursing vacancies.
Fucking hell.
Yeah. And additionally, many of those leaving had been working in the UK for up to 3 years already. So that's a lot of training and experience being spaffed up the wall. As well as all of this being, I would say, a fairly damning indictment on what it's actually like to work for the health service at the moment.
They're not leaving because it's really fun, are they?
No. And they're not leaving because they earn loads of money either. Apparently, a lot of them are going to Australia where they can earn up to double as much as a nurse. So,
in the sunshine.
It's interesting to me that of the many reasons that I think migration to the UK is a great thing. One of the biggest reasons is that migrants comprise a huge proportion of the NHS workforce, and they always have. And yet, of the many more people coming to the UK, those working in the NHS are leaving in their droves. Make it make sense?
I can't make it make sense, Jen, because unfortunately I'm not in a policy-making position. But the government in charge of spending money, who could put more money into the NHS, obviously, I'm very pleased to see that they are spending it wisely with a new Stop the Boats advert now screening in Vietnam on social media channels. I prefer Labour's three words better, which is get a grip.
We are screening an advert in Vietnam.
Yeah,
apparently about stopping the boats.
Amount of Vietnamese migrants coming over here in small boats has had a 17% increase. And so that's where the UK's money is well spent, Jen.
Right, so we're going to say to them, don't come here, please, because that's going to work really well, isn't it? It's.
I mean, I don't like our government speaking for us on pretty much anything anymore, obviously, but that is very, very British. Could you please not? Just is so British. Would you mind? Would you please?
We've made an advert for you. Wicked.
Yeah, I wish they'd spent that on the NHS.
Such pricks, aren't they?
They are. Look, I'm not going to talk about the government now, but I have some truly depressing news for anyone who believes in karma or wanted to believe in karma or comforted themselves with the knowledge that Janine, who consistently beat them up in the playground and made school a misery for a full 5 years, would surely go on to live a dull life in a horrible job and get paid a pittance. I should add that some of the names have not been changed. Bullies do not prosper. Am I right? And by that I mean, was my mum right? No. No, she wasn't. Not about that time she dressed me as a television for a fancy dress tug of war by putting a cardboard box on my head. And not about this. According to a new paper from the Institute for Social and Economic Research at the University of Essex, based on a 5-decade-long study, children who displayed aggressive behaviour at school, such as bullying or temper outbursts, are likely to earn more money in middle age. The fuckers. Those last two words are not those of the Institute for Social and Economic Research at the University of Essex, but are mine. I should probably point that out. Almost 7,000 people born in 1970 have had their lives tracked by the British Cohort Study. The research team at the University of Essex examined data from primary school teachers who assessed the children's social and emotional skills when they were 10 years old in 1980 and matched it to their lives at the age of 46 in 2016. We found that those children whose teachers felt had problems with attention, peer relationships, and emotional instability did end up earning less in the future, as we expected. But we were surprised to find a strong link between aggressive behaviour at school and higher earnings in later life, said one of the paper's authors, Professor Emilia Del Bono. Now, I've got to admit that I'm not massively surprised that some of the little ball bags in the classroom have gone on to be bigger ball bags in the boardroom or cabinet office. Just a quick glance outside my window at government officials, the police, Piers Morgan. Oi, get away from my window, Piers. Fucking hell, I'm on the first floor. It's really fucking creepy. Would indicate aggression, competitiveness, and a complete lack of empathy and self-awareness can see you very well indeed. Now, my example's notwithstanding, there's no evidence in the Institute study about whether children who were aggressive continued to be so in adulthood. But if that was a factor in their later success, then potentially good news is it may not work for younger generations, as a different research shows a generational shift where younger people expect to have a culture of belonging and being treated with fairness, respect, and kindness. I really hope that their expectation meets reality. Oh, wait. I really hope that their reality meets expectation. Both of those things.
I don't think it's enormously surprising, is it, that people who bully other people end up doing all right for themselves, because just bullied their way to get there. Not hashtag not all successful people.
Totally. But you could just look at like most of our Home Secretaries in the past 10 years and you'd be like, oh yeah, that rings true, doesn't it? Absolutely rings true.
But I mean, there's also like, you know, the entitlement that can come from certain backgrounds, shall we say.
Yeah, I like the way you said that, Jen. You kind of almost tried to reverse away from the words as you said it. It was interesting. I liked it.
My stomach's rumbling, which I think is also...
Are you hungry for power?
Yes.
I'm hungry for good news, Jen.
Well, you've come to the right place. Nice segue. I like that. Okay, well, how about this? As we record, a mere 142 years after construction began on Antoni Gaudí's Sagrada Familia, it's been reported the Barcelona Cathedral is due to be completed in 2026.
Whoa, speedy!
Yep. This date also coincides with the centenary of the death of its famous architect.
Bingo bongo, what lovely little bit of time in there.
Absolutely.
He's going to be well chuffed.
It's almost like they planned this. Anyway, there are a bunch of reasons as to why the building isn't yet complete, but I have to say, the idea that it was somehow delayed by the COVID-19 pandemic did make me chuckle a bit. It's kind of like when I leave the house 30 minutes after I should have done, but I blame my lateness on a tube that was delayed by two.
You're definitely that kind of theory of time.
Apparently, there is now both the money and the materials to finish the project, including, said The Guardian, the 172.5-metre central tower dedicated to Jesus Christ. Is that Jesus Christ or Jesus Christ?
Jesus Christ, look at the size of that tower.
I think maybe the latter, because though the project is set for completion in 2 years' time, there is like a whole other thing about a controversial staircase, which is going to take another eight. Uh-huh. So it's not really going to be finished in 2026. That's quite a misleading headline. Was that good news? Is now a good time to mention that Lorraine Kelly is getting a special award at the forthcoming television BAFTAs?
We love the Scottish, Jen, so yeah, please tell me about that.
They've not even made that connection.
Yeah, we try to forget. My mum started knitting me a jumper when I was four, and she still hasn't finished it. But she still got it, like part completed. Not going to fit me now, it was for a child. And I feel like maybe she had a hand in La Sagrada Familia.
Got to give that to one of your nieces or nephews, surely. Tell her to crack on.
Jen, it's never going to happen. But, you know, more news next time.
Well, you have equal pay, but, you know, they're not equal, are they?
Sexism of the week.
It's that time of the week where equal pay seems as distant a dream as it was in the 1970s. More so, actually. The gender pay gap for higher educated mothers, that means those who have a post-school education, has in fact widened since the 70s. With working mothers now earning 69% of working fathers' wages, whereas in 1978, they earned about 72%. Hashtag progress.
Oh, man.
But look, right, come on, bear with me. That is just your bog standard working mum's right. And as we know, very few people making policy or doling out wages give a flying shit about them. Let's talk about actually important people. Film stars. Woo! Hollywood has loads of money. So surely we'll see a difference there. I'm very aware that if I was Oliver Coleman, I'd be earning a lot more than I am, Olivia Coleman told CNN this week. That's Hollywood A-list Oscar-winning actress, all-round smasher and friend of the show, Olivia Coleman. I know of one pay disparity, which was a 12,000% difference. Do the maths, she added. Well, I can't, Olivia, but I do totally get your point. And to underline it, the latest top 10 list of the best paid actors contains just two women, Margot Robbie and Jennifer Aniston.
Also, that is surprising, right?
Well, Robbie, I guess, because of Barbie, and Aniston because one of the highest paid male actors was Adam Sandler, and she was in the film that did really well.
So
I guess that.
I suppose Margot Robbie produced Barbie as well, so she can pay herself whatever she likes. I don't know if that's how it works, to be fair.
More of that kind of thing, please. Coleman continued, research suggests that women have always been big box office draws. Don't get me started on the pay disparity. To be honest with you, I'm glad someone got us started on the pay disparity. But male actors get paid more because executives used to say male actors draw in the audiences. And actually, that hasn't been true for decades. But they still like to use that as a reason to not pay women as much as their male counterparts, particularly in our industry. am used to women being ripped off and, you know, pissed off about that on a regular basis. But ripping off Olivia Colman, there's only one word for it, and it's her favourite word, cunts.
Hear, hear.
All right, Mickey here with an advert for BetterHelp Therapy Online. You all right? Such a small question and sometimes such a big question too, eh? Now, regular listeners will know I am no stranger to depression, and while over time and with the help of some decent counselling and brilliant friends and family, I've established a toolkit to help when the constantly dripping tap of life gets a bit too much. That does not mean I am a stress-free human rainbow skipping through meadows. I mean, who is? We all carry around different stresses, big and small, and sometimes we can deal, and sometimes it's much harder to cope. Life, innit? Right now, I have a teenage puppy to deal with, and although I love her very, very much, she can be a lot. There, said it. And as quick a fix as it seemed to say, I'm fine, and push it all down into the big inside box and put that lid on. For me, that hasn't been a great long-term solution, in that if I don't get it off my chest, it will at some point come bubbling up, and it's never been one to pick its moments in a good way. I find talking means I can avoid it exploding out of me like a messy emotional volcano all over my nana's carpet. Also, during my various times in talk therapy, I discovered that saying something out loud or writing it down can make it seem much more manageable than allowing it to swirl around and grow ever bigger in my head. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. I've found knowing how to reach out is sometimes the toughest bit, but BetterHelp is entirely online. Boom. Which means it couldn't be easier. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a registered therapist, then work your sessions around your schedule. With more than 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Standard Issue listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/standard. That's betterhelp.com/standard. Hello, I'm joined on the Zoom by Steph Smith, one of our leading playwrights and screenwriter of award-winning BBC Scotland microdrama Float. Steph, hello.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. First things first, how are the cats?
The cats are currently quiet, which is a big win considering recording a podcast. I've given them loads of biscuits to try and pacify them.
You've got one that talks English, right?
It's broken English, but it's a language of sorts. It's our language.
Amazing. Okay. Let's chat about Float, the second series of which airs on iPlayer at the end of this month. And we are rejoining our protagonists, Jade and Colette, a few years down the line from the first series. But in case listeners don't know, what has been their journey so far?
Well, both seasons take place in a seaside town in rural Scotland. And season one took place over the 6 weeks of summer. And although Jade and Colette and their sort of motley crew of friends, as they were lifeguards in a local shit council pool and as they navigated the sort of trials and tribulations of being in their early 20s, yes, and there was a sort of burgeoning love between Jade and Colette in season one that for reasons, if you watch season one, you'll find out doesn't quite land in the way either of them expected. Season two takes place, as you say, 18 months later. By this point, Colette's gone off to college and Jade has very much stayed in the small town. It takes place over 6 days when Colette returns from her studies and dramatic things ensue.
I hesitate to call it a queer love story, which is how I've seen it described, because it is that at its heart, but it kind of neglects the other stuff that you're covering about being a young person, particularly a young person from the LGBTQ plus community growing up in a small town.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, isn't it? I think it's been very much packaged as a queer love story, which, as you say, it absolutely is. It's about two women navigating love and lust. But also, I think there's something about the setting as well that really interests me. I didn't grow up in a seaside town, but I grew up in a rural village. And I think there's certain qualities to growing up as just a young person in those environments that I really wanted to explore, never mind when you add in multiple identities or any sort of sexuality. Yeah, I really want to discuss the lack of opportunities within these spaces and also how that's dwindling at the moment due to the current government. I also wanted to show the pros of these spaces as well, because I think it's very easy to frame these as difficult and boring places to grow up. But obviously, there's massive pros to feeling part of a community. I think there's amazing allyship as well that happens in these spaces. And so, yeah, I really wanted to balance how I portrayed these places.
For sure. I think with a few notable exceptions, God's Own Country, I'm basically always looking at you. I think we are used to seeing these stories and these characters in an urban setting rather than small town anywhere. And of course, a lot of people do flock to cities. You know, you and I aren't from London. We both ended up in London, or people end up in the big cities in Scotland. But not everyone wants to leave, and not everyone can leave. So when there is so little of something to see available, it must feel like one hell of a responsibility to take it on.
Definitely. It does. I think the responsibility of portraying two young women navigating a relationship, I feel very acutely, because as you say, it's still deeply underrepresented on our screens. And I think because I loved growing up somewhere rural, it really defined who I am. And actually, it probably defined me as much as being a gay woman. And so I wanted to portray it honestly. And also, I think the thing I always feel like I have to say about the series is it's not autobiographical. I think because it's so, because the marriage of queer relationship in rural space is so rarely portrayed, that people just must assume that I'm writing about my story. That surely you can only write about this if it's exactly as you lived it. But I can say my upbringing and teenagehood was and 20s were very different to Jade and Colette. But yeah, it's really interesting. I think people really think one of them must be me, and it's really not. My life wasn't that exciting.
Also, Jade is a very angry young woman, which again, even though they clearly exist wherever you're placing something, it isn't something we really see much on screens, is it?
No, and I think we look at it in season one, but we look at it, I would say, even deeper in season two, about the tools that young women are given to deal with their anger, which I think, to be honest, aren't great. I wanted to find a way of articulating how these two young women are navigating their disappointments and disgruntlements with the things that life has thrown at them. Again, it felt like an underrepresented thing on screen. And when I was working on Float, I thought, you know, when I was 18, what would I have loved to watch? What would have felt like I would have, well, found entertaining, but also what would have spoken to me? And I think looking at how young women deal with these big, messy emotions felt like something I really wanted to lean into.
There are a couple of lines that made me proper quack laughing, basically because I recognised it as well. So there's one where Jade, who is suffering a mental health crisis when we first meet her in season one and is then dealing with depression and these anger issues, she says, "No one tells you how boring it is feeling like this." That was like a true story. Yeah.
Totally. I'm so sick of my own thoughts. Yeah. And I think there is a lot of, it's so funny, isn't it, talking about your own work. I hope that people find it witty as well as sort of moving, and that there's sort of a motley crew that surrounds them, and hopefully they bring a bit of levity and wit as well.
There's definitely huge storylines about friendship as well. I think that's as key as the love story.
Oh, yeah. And I think, again, I think friendships between women is also underexplored truthful way on the screen. And so, yes, that was definitely something to look at. And I think the other thing to say is in season two, I bring in both of their mums into the storyline. And I loved just representing that sort of intergenerational play between mums and daughters. And just to widen out the cast a bit was a real gift and something I really relished getting a second bite of the cherry, if you will, to tell a slightly bigger story in season two.
Okay, Steph, it's called Float. The first season set in a swimming pool and they live by the sea. Mm-hmm. What's with all the water?
Yeah. Good question. And I've never been asked that before. I think, how long have you got? there's often a marriage between stories about women and water, and it feels... like a sort of trope that I wanted to jump off, if you will. And I think there's something about, without sounding too wanky, the sort of metaphor of being above the water or below the water, you know, whether you're thriving or drowning. And that felt like a really useful idea for where these characters are at. It feels like at any point they could drown or at any point they could thrive. That was a sort of useful baseline when I'm thinking about the journeys of these characters. And also, it's just beautiful.
It is gorgeous.
It's very televisual. And also, there's something about Scotland that feels elemental. And I wanted to try, and as much as we are in a small town, I think the proximity to real wilderness that you get in Scotland, and of course you get that in England and Wales and Ireland as well, but I think you feel it so acutely in Scotland that you're only ever 5 minutes away from feeling like you're in the middle of nowhere. And I think the water, particularly in the second season, there's more wild water than, say, the swimming pool. And I just wanted to showcase that part of Scotland as well, because it feels like it would be in the DNA of these characters as well.
And the ocean, for me, is somewhere, even though I'm from Wigan, which isn't, you know, it's got a canal. It's not really got the ocean, but it's not far. I guess that's the other thing. Wherever we are in the UK, we're not massively far from the ocean, but it's got perspective. It's so big that anything that feels like it's dominating our life can feel small. And I mean that in a very positive way.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, exactly. It's that. Excuse the pun, it's a wave of perspective, isn't it? When you just look out and see nothing.
Absolutely.
It's an expanse. Yeah, it does a lot of holding for us, the ocean, doesn't it? With lots of different emotions.
Totally. The BBC have dubbed Float a microdrama. For the listeners, could you explain what that means?
What does that mean?
Dear BBC.
Yeah, indeed. Definitely quickly Google. No, a microdrama, I suppose, I don't know what the technical term is, but for me it's a drama where every episode's less than 15 minutes. You know, maybe like interesting to talk about where this came from, actually, and came from a scheme from BBC Writers Room, which is like an in-house development strand of the BBC to help develop writers and make screenwriting feel more accessible. I've done various schemes through them and I feel very thankful for that, because my background's playwriting and I felt very green. I knew nothing about telewriting, and much of my knowledge has come from doing various things with the Writers Room. And they put a pitch out where they were asking for microdramas for the audience. I think the ages were between 16 and 22. I think we were trying to capture that audience, which is a bit like, I think that's for telly folk, that's like the gold dust audience that everyone wants to try and get watching the content. But and so I came up with the idea of Float, and they made a pilot. I think they made four pilots, and then of the four pilots they made, the one was going to go to series, and I was lucky that was Float. So actually, even in the first series, we filmed the pilot, and then I think a year later we filmed the rest of the series. And so I actually had to put in a line in episode 2, season 1, about Jade getting a haircut, because the actor had like a really severe haircut. I had to sort of slightly crowbar in the reason why she suddenly got a crew cut compared to episode 1, where she's got much longer hair. But yes, so it feels like a very homegrown piece. And, you know, it's made on an incredibly small budget. For lots of those actors, it was the first time they'd ever been on screen. It was the director's screen debut. It was my screenwriting debut. The heads of department. And I think for most of them, it was the first time they'd done that with costume and set and stuff. There was a real sense of it being a team sport. And also that everyone felt like they were stepping up a bit. It's just a real joy and tenderness with that team that I think has come from that space of it being so grassroots. There's a lot of love in that team for everybody. And from looking at other writers' experience, that doesn't always happen in telly, so I feel very lucky for that.
I think that comes through when you're watching it, though, as well. Like, tender, I don't know, we're so cynical these days. Tender seems like a bit of a wishy-washy word, but it's not. It is really tender. And though the episodes are short, the drama is big. And you very quickly, and this is testament to your writing skill, you very quickly are on board with them and you want them to thrive. You want them to do well. You want them to not be struggling, as some of them are.
Oh, I'm a sucker for tenderness, you know. I think you're right. People are very cynical about it.
Are you a soppy sausage?
I am a soppy sausage and browned. And I think also, like, it's funny you should say tender, actually, because when I was writing season 1, I was really aware of the lack of tenderness around queer love stories. Sometimes, I don't know, they felt volatile or traumatic. And actually, I really wanted to lean in the tenderness of what it means to be in your early 20s. Because for me, as much as it isn't autobiographical, like, I felt that tenderness in my early 20s. And I think that was really something I wanted to showcase. So yeah, I say let's go for the tenderness. I'm all for it.
The second series of Float lands on BBC iPlayer at the end of this month, and the first is already there for the binging. I recommend you do. That's how I watched it. It was delightful. You have got some other exciting stuff in the pipeline, Steph. Are you allowed to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, I can tell you about some of it for sure. My next theatre project is in the International Festival in Edinburgh, and it'll be on for all of August, and it's an adaptation of the memoir by Amy Littrop called The Outrun, and it follows her journey from Orkney to London to back again to Orkney, and it looks at many things. You could say at the core of it is her recovery from alcoholism and addiction, and amongst those things, it looks at wild swimming, the landscape, how nature's an important aspect of recovery. Feels like very rooted in the landscape of Orkney, but also the landscape of London. And yes, so I am attempting to adapt that prestige.
I've no doubt your attempt will be absolutely brilliant. And more water stuff.
More water, I know, right? There's a thing, isn't there? And I should say it's directed by Vicky Featherstone. And there's an incredible new score from Luke Sutherland, who's a musician and writer from Orkney. Been in the band Mogwai. He has written multiple novels. He's an incredible collaborator. And so again, it feels like a team sport, that one. It's a real joy.
Exciting. Where can people keep an eye on you on the socials to find out where they can keep up with that and go and see it and what's next?
Oh, I mean, you can follow me on Twitter, but you will just see loads of pictures of my cats.
I mean, I'm in. Because that is the nicest thing that's happening on Twitter/X at the moment, isn't it?
I know. Do you know what, my partner, Jessica Oskew, she said that she only ever tries to put good things out on Twitter. And I think I really tried to follow suit that to try and put some joy in the world when it comes to Twitter, because there's maybe a lack of it
just a bit
on there at the moment. Mm-hmm. But yes, I'm under Steph Smith on Twitter. That's the best place to keep up to date with my cats more than anything.
Steph, thank you so much for chatting with me.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been a real joy.
You play ball like a girl!
Go on, do one, kid. Jenny off the blocks.
Welcome to Jenny off the blocks, that time of the week where the crowd goes wild as we discuss all things women's sport. First up, an enormous tip of the hat to Jasmine Paris, or maybe tip of the electrolyte drink, or a family-sized bag of jelly babies, who knows. You've probably read about Jasmine already this week after she became the first female runner and one of just 20 people ever to have completed the Barclay Marathons in Tennessee. That is, since it was extended to 100 miles back in 1989, I should say, from a mere 55 miles previously. I mean, 55 miles is a lot, don't get me wrong, but a 45-mile extension, well, I mean, I'm sure you can do the maths, even I can. So it's not just that it's 100 miles long, consisting of 5 20-mile off-trail loops. It also has to be completed in 60 hours from the start of the first loop. Now, I did a charity walk once, a walk which was, I think, 40 miles in 24 hours. I struggle to remember, to be honest. I think I repressed most of the memories I have of it, except for one point in the wee small hours of the morning when I thought to myself quite seriously that probably the only way to make my feet stop hurting would be to amputate my own little toe. Listen, I didn't go through with it, but my toe has never been the same since. That was a walk of less than half the distance. So what I'm trying to say to you is, fuck me, it really is hard to comprehend how difficult that must have been and the kind of mental challenge she faced as well as physical. I've done quite a lot of endurance sports events in my time, and I have to say that that overnight walk was the hardest by far. Jasmine has form here. Jasmine from Midlothian, I should add. What's that? Scotland. Correct, listeners. Scotland. Last year, she had a crack at the three-loop fun run. That's right, they're calling it a fun run. But this year, the 40-year-old went the full shebang, finishing with just minutes to spare. It's an absolutely mad race, which you should definitely look up. It was dreamt up by Gary Lazarus Lake Cantrell, an endurance race designer who'd heard about how James Earl Ray, the assassin of Martin Luther King, covered a mere 12 miles in 50 hours after escaping from nearby Brushy Mountain State, I can't say this word, penitentiary? You know what I mean. And was like, I could do better than that. Actually, what he said was, I could do at least 100 miles. I mean, I could definitely do more than 12 if my life depended on it. And 12 miles is pretty shit in 54 hours under any circumstances, to be honest. Anyway, Jasmine said afterwards that she was glad to have done it for herself, but also for women worldwide as well. Any woman that wants to take on a challenge and maybe doesn't have the confidence, she said. The idea that I might have inspired them to believe in themselves, that's huge, especially all the young girls. You know how hard it is to keep young girls in sports. Excuse me, my hormones are in disarray this week, so this is a bit tricky. Anyway, linking seamlessly, aren't we glad that superwomen like Jasmine exist? Because new research was published in the last week highlighting the difference that these role models are making when it comes to young girls and sport. A study by OnePoll on behalf of Scottish Gas, official partner of the Scotland women's rugby team. Okay, I swear to God, this is a coincidence now. They asked 500 10 to 17-year-olds about their attitudes towards sport and found that 65% said that seeing successful women in sport had boosted their confidence, while 55% said it made them feel like they could do anything. No, you're crying. But even more so, 38% said that they've been inspired by seeing their mum, sister, auntie or other, and this is a quote from express.co.uk now, lesser known females engaging in exercise. I mean, to me, as you can probably tell, this is quite emotional. Now, I don't want to end on a low, nor do I want to parrot anything outrage-inducing said by irrelevant former footballers recently, but I was reading an article at the weekend about why some men find women's football and sport in general so, and I quote, triggering, which cites some research by Stacey Pope, professor in the Department of Sport and Exercise Sciences at Durham University. The 2022 research found that 68% of 1,950 men's football fans quizzed on the subject revealed openly misogynistic attitudes towards the increased visibility of women's sport. So the question here is, why? You know, what difference does it make to you if there's a bit of netball on the telly? And if you ask me, which you didn't, but you are listening to my podcast, so, you know, I'll have a punt at this. It's for exactly the reasons I've been chatting about today, because what is more threatening to the status quo than a confident young woman? Talk about the Jasmines of this world and not the Joeys. Right, that's all from me this week, and I'll be back next time with more women's sport.
Welcome to Rated or Dated. Hannah Dunleavy, scorner of romance. You have picked a romance. Explain yourself.
Is it a romance? Discuss. We'll get to that. This week, we watched Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which I saw in a cinema in Nottingham, and I remember very clearly because that audience was expecting a very different Jim Carrey film. It was written by Charlie Kaufman and directed by Michel Gondry, who got his first big break when Björk asked him to direct the video for Human Behaviour. And it features a Beck cover of Everybody's Gotta Learn Sometime. This film couldn't be more early 2000s if it was about somebody updating his MySpace page before having a few WKDs and invading Iraq.
I think I used to follow them on MySpace.
Guys, have you seen this?
Yes.
Yes.
I used to have it on DVD. Somebody borrowed it and never gave it me back. And I was okay about it.
I must have watched it when I was at uni. No, after post-uni, because I've graduated in 2004 and I don't think I would have seen this at cinema. So I have seen it, but I don't remember too much about it. I didn't love it at the time.
Okay, so for context, this wasn't Carey's first serious role. He'd already picked up Golden Globes for The Truman Show and Man on the Moon. But Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind was still seen as a departure for the actor. Particularly, it seems, in Nottingham.
Are they our new Scotland?
Kerr is joined by a rock-solid cast. Kate Winslet, Kirsten Dunst, Tom Wilkinson, oh. Elijah Wood, David Cross, and Mark Ruffalo rocking his greatest ever haircut. Don't at me. The film had success in all the right areas, making $74 million from a $20 million budget, picking up an Oscar for Best Original Screenplay, and placing on many critics' lists of the best film of the 2000s. The title, as the film tells us, comes from Alexander Pope, more specifically Eloisa to Abelard, which is about real-life doomed medieval lovers. I bring that up not because I want to be all, oh, I know who they are, but because it's a perfect example of how much I learned from one particular TV programme. Mickey, you'll know this. Someone found a copy of the letters of Abelard and Eloise in the toilet of a bloke they were sleeping with. And while it does sound like me, it wasn't me. Who was it? What TV programme has taught us more than any other TV programme?
Well, for me, it's probably The Sopranos. Oh, The Sopranos. There you go.
Carmella found a copy of the book in a toilet.
Oh, of course. Yes, of course.
So let's get to the plot. Joel, that's Carey, decides to ditch work and get on a train to the seaside where he meets Clementine, that's Winslet. And it looks like that this is going somewhere. Cut to Joel, distraught after discovering their relationship isn't just over. Clementine has a new boyfriend and won't even acknowledge Joel's presence. But this isn't the future, it's the past, because it turns out she's erased the part of her memory that contains Joel, a procedure offered by the rabble of Wilkinson, Wood, Ruffalo and Dunst. Unable to put up with the pain slash out of spite, you decide, Joel decides to do the same. But midway through the procedure, with the secrets of the doctor's office spilling out around him, he changes what's left of his mind. As he struggles to hold on to any memory of Clementine, their relationship plays out backwards until it is all gone. But after meeting again, their medical files are sent to them and they find out what they did, leaving them with a choice to try again or to accept defeat. As I said at the top, I saw this with a friend. And having got my powder wet last week saying that on that occasion, I loved it. And bearing in mind what you said earlier, Mickey, about it being a romance, I'm going to say that what impressed me most about this film then and actually continues to impress me now is that my friend is a romantic and I'm a cynic. And we both came out feeling like our worldviews had been vindicated. Because on the one hand, it says, what's for you won't go by you. And on the other hand, it says, most of us just repeat the same mistakes over and over again. What do you think it's saying?
To me, like, she very clearly, and maybe him as well, I think he's maybe a bit depressed or something, but she is, like, not a well woman, right? So, to me, it's not terribly romantic that they wind up getting back together.
I think it's got some interesting thoughts on memory and how we remember things differently. I think that's really interesting. Like, two people in the same situation with the same experience could remember it really, really differently. I think, yeah, what you said, Hannah, you know, what is meant to come to you will come to you and nothing you can do can sort of stop that. And also, we are destined to repeat the same mistakes again. But I also do not like the implication that they're going to try again because they're clearly not suited to each other and they're just going to go through the pain again. Is that worth it for a few snatched moments of happiness? Well, potentially for some people, but the thing that bothered me on this particular watch is they don't seem to have very many happy moments at all in their initial relationship. They don't seem to get on. She's all manic pixie dream girl and he is depressed. I suppose we're supposed to think of him as kind of quite a cool indie kid, but indie man. But yeah, I don't feel like they were ever a great romance to try to recapture that.
And it's interesting because the couple that think they were great are in the most terrible relationship themselves.
Yeah.
To me, it doesn't... If that's what the film is, for me, really cynical. I think this film is really cynical. I don't see the romance in it at all. That doesn't make it a bad film to me. That's just, come on, confirm my worldview.
Well, we are set to rehash the same patterns, aren't we? Unless we actually do something to change them.
Well, Kirsten Dunst does something to change them. Mary makes a move and does something to change it because she immediately falls into the same pattern and it's unconscious, isn't it? You know?
Yeah.
The question of, would I do that again? Probably yes, because I'm the same person that I was before that memory was removed from me. So of course I'm going to make the same mistake again.
They're literally removing as well as the pain in inverted commas and the heartache and having to get over that and having to travel through that. They're literally removing the benefit of hindsight.
The lesson, yeah, absolutely.
And that's the bit that's most worrying, I think.
Now, you've both referred to this, so let's just get out and ask the question. Clementine, manic pixie dream girl or something a bit more diagnosable? What do you think?
Exhausting? Can we diagnose her as exhausting?
She's hard work, isn't she? I think she's unwell, is my reading of her, but I mean, I don't know if that's what they intend for us to think. But she's very, very, she's so volatile, isn't she? She's like absolutely all over the shop.
Yes. She's a bit old, actually, to be a manic pixie dream girl, even though she's, I think, 14 years younger than Carrie here. The age gaps in this film are quite interesting. She's probably too old to fall into manic pixie dream girl, but it's almost like that's what she wants to be. She comes across as pretty unhinged. Is part of that to do with the procedure?
Are we supposed to think... Because I think she is portrayed as absolutely, unhinged.
I wouldn't go as far as to say unhinged, but...
Do you think that's...
Sorry,
well, all right, I'll go with what I said then, very volatile. She's got very volatile moods. Are we supposed to think that that is, like, attractive? I'm not sure
she's so chimerial.
I don't know. She is attractive, though, isn't she?
So, well, I mean, she's gorgeous,
lovely looking. Yeah. She's a lovely looking bird. But, like, I mean, like, are we supposed to think... Is that part of, like, what draws them together? Are we, like, that kind of damage that they both have? Are we supposed to think that that is presented? Because I watch it and I'm like, fucking hell, this is a lot. But do you think it was intended that that would somehow kind of, like, add to her allure?
Yeah, I think she's supposed to be exciting and spontaneous, whereas... And particularly for Carrie's character, for Joel, who is a bit stuck and is worried that he's really boring. You know, he's worried that he's really boring. So this absolute burst of chaotic energy is a jolt for his life. And in the end, doesn't work because they're very, very different. And she ends up finding him boring.
So then is that like sexy psycho?
A little bit. I think there's, you know, definitely an aspect of she's supposed to be sexy psycho in there.
She's very good in it, I will say. She looks fantastic in her costumes, particularly when she is in the 60s in the kitchen and he's under the table. She looks absolutely knockout in that.
And I think Kate Winslet, like you say, she plays it really, really well. And it's unusual for her to have that kind of quirky role. And I don't know that she's had, I mean, are there that many as quirky roles and that kind of filming available? No, it's like very, very Kaufman, isn't it?
I think she had had quirky roles. I mean, she started off in Heavenly Creatures, which is quirky.
Is that the one with Harvey Keitel?
It's the one where she...
It's the murderers, isn't it? The New Zealand. Yeah. Peter Jackson, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really early Peter Jackson. And the one with Harvey Keitel, was she in a cult or something and he got her out of it?
Hideous Kinky, yeah. I think that's called.
Hideous Kinky, that's the one, Jen. Yeah.
I think that she kind of did that thing where she obviously did Titanic or whatever, and then it was a bit like, oh, she's going to become like, you know, sort of little starlet, poster girl, whatever. But then I think she seems to have tried quite hard to take quite different roles going forward. But maybe, I think there probably was like very much a danger of that at the time, Mick.
I found a quote here about Jim Carrey. It's... Although I've managed to cut who it's from out, so apologies if you're listening. It's rarely a compliment when I refer to an actor as straitjacketed, but the straitjacketing of Jim Carrey here is fiercely poignant. You see all that manic comic energy imprisoned in this ordinary man, with an anarchism peeking out and trying to find a way to express itself. I just think that's pretty spot on.
Yeah.
I think that's really fair, yeah. It's good.
That's what I meant when I said to you the other week, although I think indeed I did cut it from the thing, but when I said the other week when we talked about this that, like, to me it's like I can see Jim Carrey trying to get out. I can see the real Jim Carrey desperately trying to get out, and
you don't want him to get out, do you, Jen?
I really don't want him to get out, and so
neither.
That's actually too much for me to bear, even watching him trying to get out.
The thought of him escaping just upsets you so much. I think he's excellent in it. I think he's so good. I think the two leads are so good. I think the supporting cast are flawless as well. I love the performances, particularly with such... It must have been such a bonkers film to make. Although maybe not, because films aren't filmed in order anyway, right?
Yeah.
So the fact that this is so non-linear, maybe they didn't really notice it as different to filming anything else.
On that note, Elijah Wood is incredibly good in this. He is such a weasel. It is absolutely
so creepy.
Incredible.
Yeah.
And what I really like about this film is, number one, he tells all this stuff he's done to Mark Ruffalo's character, and Mark Ruffalo's character is absolutely horrified.
Yeah.
Completely horrified, as he should be. But well done, 2004, for pointing out that he should be. And secondly, the plot does not make her pick between these two men. In fact, she doesn't even find out what Elijah Wood has done to her. She just can smell the crazy on him and fucks him off out of there, which, again, I think is a laudable plot point.
Yeah, and he creeps her out, I think, because he is inherently creepy, but also because it's that idea that with Jim Carrey's character, with Joel, we see that it's not working properly. We see that he is fighting it. We see that the good memories are the ones that make him go, hang on, maybe I regret this, and start to fight to keep those. And I think with her, when Elijah Wood's character is using Joel's words to woo her because he knows it works, there's a deja vu factor that she's like, yeah. She doesn't know why she's feeling it, but she's feeling it. And it is that kind of things of, we can't erase, we can't push down the things that have most affected us. They will find a way to fuck us over.
In a lot of ways, it's like the lead up to drunk calling, isn't it? What he goes through. In that, you know, you get drunk and then you're like, oh God, they were such a bell end. It was so awful. I'm better off without them. Like, half a bottle of whiskey in, you're like, oh, they made me so happy, I should ring them.
He's reached for his rose-tinted glasses. Oh, yeah. It was really lovely when we went and made ice angels.
You talk about how this is made. Now, apparently CGI in this was kept to an absolute minimum. So on the one hand, it's aged quite well because the stuff was actually shot like cleverly and you can't see glaring effects in it. On the other hand, and I haven't seen this for ages, only an SD version available to watch on Amazon, yeah. Not an HD version. So it does look quite grainy. So from that perspective, it should be rated in that it still looks great, but somehow it looks dated because they're not giving us the full HD version.
My mum said something about this. She said, is it something to do with like films of that time where they all look sort of brown? And I was like, I don't really know what you're talking about, Kat.
But I think they look sort of a bit blue, actually. They all look sort of a bit blue and steely. Films in SD.
I didn't notice.
Okay, last question before rated or dated, obviously. Would you, if you, what would erase your memory now?
No, absolutely not. And, like, there are some really genuinely, I'm smiling as I say this, but some really horrific moments in my past that were not from then and are not for now, but everything has gone into making me who I am today and get me where I am today. So no, I wouldn't.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because obviously my boyfriend is someone who I went out with previously and had a terrible time with.
Did you two go to see Tom Wilkinson?
What was it like when they did it to you, Jen?
Well, let me tell you, we have not forgotten. We have definitely not forgotten the first time round.
They've got the files.
No. I mean, it's a nice idea though, isn't it? Because there's definitely, I mean, it's a horrific idea, but that is how you often feel, isn't it? When you come out of a relationship with someone, quite a lot of the time, you would just rather forget the whole fucking thing.
But it's a sticking plaster on a broken leg in a way, yeah, isn't it? Because totally. You were also erasing the stuff that you've learned about yourself. Anne Johnson, Mother Mick, wise words. She said, when you come out of a relationship, Mick, you'll have learned things about yourself and you're going to learn stuff that you want and stuff that you don't want. Unfortunately, it's usually stuff that you don't want in your next relationship, but it's really important. And so, yeah, you're kind of doing yourself out of future happiness if you erase everything.
Can I just say, I gave almost exactly the same advice to my friend Karen this weekend about buying a camper for her.
And I now am married to a really lovely camper van.
Oh, I wish you the very best.
I struggle to hold on to memories at the best of times. Jesus, I don't need more stuff disappearing out of my brain.
That's kind of the point, I guess, that if we're destined to rehash the same mistakes, because they don't know, so they ain't learned. They haven't learned anything. They can't take anything away from it.
Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, rated or dated?
Rated, but I've got to add the caveat that I'm not a huge fan of it. I would never reach for it again. I don't think I need to see it again. It's a little bit too chaotic for me. It's very clever, but I think it stands up. I think what it's saying is really good. I think the performances are really good. Just not for me.
Yeah, I agree with literally everything you've just said, Mickey. So yeah, I don't think it's dated, but I don't love it.
Yeah, I don't think it's dated, but I don't love it, but I do think it's really good. I probably, again, I mean, I don't think I'd rent it, but if I turned on the telly and it was on, I would probably watch it. Next week,
we are watching The Neverending Story.
Oh, man.
Just automatically waiting for you to burst into song there, Mickey, but maybe people have to wait till next week.
You can see me fidgeting on my seat as I try desperately not to break into song.
I tell you what, when you appear on Zoom next week, if you haven't got full Amal hair, I'm going to be really disappointed.
Standard issue for all women.